Well, welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. It's the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for a thoughtful discussion and reflection and debate. So I hope you enjoy today's show. Just a reminder, right at the top of the show, and I'm doing this every week up till the tour, that we have a great tour coming up from William Lane Craig, who is probably the world's foremost defender of Christianity on an intellectual footing. And he is coming over to the UK for 10 days from October the 17th to the 26th for the Reasonable Faith Tour. Premier, along with Damaris and Be Thinking and UCCF, are all involved in sponsoring that tour, hosting some of those debates. And Premier are going to be kicking it off with a debate on the existence of God at Westminster Central Hall. William Lane Craig will be debating Stephen Law, atheist philosopher. And I do hope, if you're around, if you live within striking distance, you've booked your tickets and invited a friend along too. premier.org.uk/Craig if you'd like to book in for this tour, and indeed for many of the other events that you can find out about there as well. premier.org.uk/Craig to get your tickets. Don't forget, there's a special Apologetics Day conference as well, which will also feature, as well as Bill, John Lennox, Gary Habermas and Peter J. Williams. A different Peter Williams to the one we've got on today's programme, though. So let me introduce who we've got on Unbelievable this afternoon. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, Peter S. Williams joins me in the studio alongside Jeff Crocker. Now, let me tell you about these guys. Peter S. Williams is a Christian philosopher and apologist, author of many books, including I Wish I Could Believe in Meaning, which may be relevant to today's programme. But you can find a whole host of books that he's written, and I'll put some links to them with today's programme. My atheist guest on today's programme is Jeff Crocker, a former Christian, now an atheist. But he's concerned that maybe we lack a sense of meaning and value in an atheistic framework. How do we recover a sense of that? And he's got a new book out called An Enlightened Philosophy, so he's going to tell us all about that. As we ask today on the question, can an atheist believe in meaning? Hope you enjoy today's programme. Welcome, gentlemen, both. Great to have you both with me here. Now, Jeff, thank you for coming in. You're new to the programme, so it'd be good to get a little bit of a sense of background from you, and then we'll come to you, Peter, for your background, as you haven't come on for quite a while, and people may be interested to hear where you're coming from. But, Jeff, thank you for coming in today. You were a Christian, Jeff. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, thanks for your invitation to join you, Justin and Peter. I grew up in Derby, a grey industrial Midlands town, and really enjoyed my school days there. And during that period of time, I joined an evangelical Anglican church, and I became at an early age convinced of a Christian understanding. And I guess it was on two bases. One, that I did consider that the creation, as I then saw it, required a designer. I thought the random explanation wasn't very credible. And secondly, I thought that humanity was certainly faltered and needed some salvation, some forgiveness, some salve in its understanding. So those might sound rather generic motives or first thoughts for a 14-year-old. But by the age of 15, I'd read all that John Stott and various others had written and became an evangelical Christian. So that journey continued for a large number of years, really, 20, 30 years, and I was more and more involved in church life, the majority of it in charismatic Anglican church life, but also extensively abroad. And I spoke at church conferences in various countries, in Europe, in the States, in Africa, where I worked a lot in Ghana, in South Africa prior to the apartheid regime coming down, working with the black churches there, in Russia prior and since the communist regime, in East Germany, working a lot with the Lutheran Church there prior to the reform movement overthrowing Honecker's regime. So quite a lot of intensive involvement. And I published a Bible study guide called Living Word, which was used in home groups in lots of churches. And that went out in several languages too. So I had a pretty heavy commitment and involvement of a large core of my life.
This was no dalliance. This was a firmly committed life, you know, involved in gospel, in the gospel.
Yes. Well, in Christian interpretations, yes. Mm. So I then came to a crisis in life. The crisis was engendered both behaviorally and in terms of belief. The behavioral one was I went through a very sad part of church life, which knew so much conflict. People were tearing each other apart. So, you know, grace got thrown out of church life, and behaviour became a contradiction of grace rather than an expression of it. And those things, if they continue long enough, can seriously erode somebody's position, because if the church isn't the incarnation of the grace it believes in, it hardly has any standing. But secondly, in terms of belief, some of the fundamental beliefs that I had held to suddenly began to unravel. People often speak of the belief in hell as being the one that unravels first because they find it non-credible. For me, actually, it was the concept of forgiveness as understood by evangelical Christianity. And the more I pondered it, the idea that God forgave because he beat up somebody else, i.e. his son, seemed to me a zero-sum concept of forgiveness. Right. So when I forgive, or when you forgive, or when Peter forgives, we don't go and beat up somebody else in order to forgive the first person. Mm. So the interpretation suddenly seemed extremely lacking to me, and actually a very defective concept of forgiveness. And I wanted to find a much higher concept of forgiveness that didn't involve taking it out on somebody else. So it led me to feel that the interpretations that I had held dear were actually rather lacking. I was working in Russia for about 20 years in an atheist society, and I saw huge values amongst people working in Soviet industry. The head of the coal industry was a personal friend of mine, and so on. And I saw here was a society without any creed, without any data knowledge even of the Christian claims, but yet a society with great personal and interpersonal values. So all of those things shifted me to seek a fresh interpretation, having lost that evangelical definition of faith, which I am pretty critical about in the middle section of my book.
Well, it's a fascinating journey, and it gave birth to the book we're going to be looking at today, An Enlightened Philosophy, that you've written. We'll come back to that in a moment's time. Peter S. Williams, joins me today. Peter, you're a Christian philosopher and apologist. Very interesting story we just heard there from Jeff. What's your story, and does it interact in any way with Jeff's?
Much more prosaic, I think, really. Again, I was brought up in a Christian context, but I never had a time where I moved away from that. Mine was, I guess, a process as I gradually grew older and came to understand more of what was being claimed and promulgated, asking, do I really believe this is true, and do I believe it for myself rather than simply because my family, my immediate sort of cultural situation says this is the done thing. And it was just the fact that for me, every time I sort of asked those questions and went through that sort of mind and soul searching, I always answered in the positive. That yes, I did think this was true, and yes, I was committed to it for myself rather than simply for cultural reasons. So,
That's, I mean, you've got a book actually, as Jeff mentioned there, this issue, theological issue with the idea of forgiveness and the penal atonement.
I have a lot of sympathy with your problems with some of the interpretations of that particular, the doctrine of atonement within certain circles. And I can empathise very much with some of the difficulties that certain ways of expressing what's going on in the atonement have for people.
We're going to talk about that next week, actually. And if you're tuning in thinking that we were going to be talking about that this week, because I did advertise it last week, Peter's new book, Understanding Jesus, we're going to actually leave that off for 1 week and come back next week for a fascinating discussion on the person of Jesus, and some sceptics coming on the phone to ask questions of Peter about Jesus and his new book. But today we're focusing on, Jeff, your book, and the book says that you believe faith can be interpreted as kind of reevaluated, that it can be interpreted as myth, and that this in some sense is a better way of seeing faith, and it also gives us meaning and value that perhaps is lacking otherwise in an atheistic framework. Do you want to sort of give us the core thesis of the book, as it were?
Yeah, so the core thesis is looking at the present conflict and confrontation between doctrinally expressed Christianity, as represented by the Protestant churches and the Catholic churches too, And militant atheism as expressed by Richard Dawkins and other people writing as he does. This has become a pretty militant confrontation. So, I mean, it wasn't long ago that one side was taking out adverts on buses saying there is no God, and the other side was taking out adverts on the other side of the bus saying there is a God. So, you know, apart from confusing the buses, the confrontation is a stalemate. So, having found myself dumped into the wider sea of atheist thinking, and it clearly in Western Europe it is the majority perspective. It doesn't make it right necessarily, but there are a lot of people in this particular park in life. Having found myself there, trying to look at this conflict and seeing if there were other interpretations that brought us greater mutuality, greater understanding, and some synthesis. So the critique is doctrinal Christianity has a number of weaknesses, which I've just alluded to one about forgiveness, but a number of others too that I've critiqued and others have critiqued. And the existence of God is critiquable as well from an atheist position. But the atheist position has its weakness too. It has its weakness, A, that it's extremely fundamentalist, so it's extremely difficult to debate detail within this militant atheist position, even if you yourself are an atheist. The slightest deviance from the Darwin, Mendel, W.D. Hamilton perspective on biology, for example, isn't met with any readiness to debate at all. So there is a very fundamentalist mindset within militant atheism. But the biggest critique I have is that it has no account of the metaphysical element of human life. It is essentially reductionist, and it claims itself to be reductionist, i.e. everything is only physical. Mm. Well, everything may only be physical, but nevertheless, this physical does generate a metaphysical existence. We do have an intellectual element to our being. We have a spiritual element to our being. We have an emotional element to our being. And all of that metaphysical element of the human experience finds no account in militant atheism. So therefore, the challenge was, I guess, or the suggestion, whichever way you want to put it, is for militant atheism to recognize the metaphysical in humanity, even if it's only a transient metaphysical whilst we're alive. In other words, if there is no eternal life, there is still a spiritual life while we are alive. And for the church to look at myth as a more powerful interpretation than doctrine. So having critiqued doctrine quite extensively in the book, I then try to assert the superior interpretation, as you say, of myth. Now, myth not with a small m meaning something that's trivial and not true and the Father Christmas story, but myth as being a strong social narrative. And my argument is that religion at its best does contribute wonderful, strong, poetic meta-narratives in human society. And I take several examples in the book. So I take the example of Cain and Abel, well-known story certainly to Bible readers in the book of Genesis. And I say, well, you can't really weave a doctrine around the Cain and Abel story. There is no doctrine. Believing in it literally or not doesn't really make any difference. But the significance of this story in terms of sibling rivalry, in terms of jealousy that leads to hatred, that leads to murder, and in terms of the divine view that there is another way of behaving, i.e., as God says to Cain, if you do well, you'll also be accepted. These are wonderful myths with a capital M. Sadly, many very well-educated atheists know none of them at all because they are biblically illiterate. The church is peddling its doctrinal interpretations, and I claim missing the goal, missing the meaning. There is a meaning there, but it is more in terms of myth than in terms of doctrine, and I try to explore it, and I try to show in the book that there is actually a synthesis. For example, if you take the theme of justice, a lot of the mentions of words like righteousness in the Bible are equally interpretable as justice, and therefore a much greater concern for the agenda of justice comes out than comes out of doctrinal Christianity, and it does square with the atheist concern, spiritual atheist concern, equally for justice. So there's a synthesis, I suggest.
Interesting stuff. Let's get into the discussion now. And if you'd like to give your thoughts on today's discussion, I do invite your emails. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also interact via the Facebook and Twitter accounts, and the links to those are both from the Unbelievable webpage at premier.org.uk/ unbelievable. We're talking today, can an atheist believe in meaning? And we're hearing Jeff Crocker, who, former Christian, now an atheist, believes that there is a way of synthesizing religion to be interpreted as myth that helps in that regard. Peter S. Williams, though, Christian philosopher and apologist, is going to be in conversation with Jeff today on the programme as he looks at what he claims in the book and whether atheists can believe in meaning. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, Peter, may come back to you. Hearing what Jeff has had to say there, I'm sure, as you've already said, you can sympathise with aspects of his story and the journey he took. But do you sympathise with the way he then interprets religion as a myth, as a way of kind of giving a sort of sense of value and grounding that is actually better than doctrines and or indeed the other sort of side of the coin, dogmatic atheism?
Well, I certainly have elements of sympathy with what you're saying. I'm minded of C.S. Lewis's phrase about the incarnation being myth become fact, without losing any of its mythological elements in its large M sense of the meaning, but differing from other myths in that it was also something that actually happened on the Christian view. So one could certainly take useful meanings out of stories, whether or not one believes that they're true. But if one believes that they're true, they can have additional meanings and implications vis-a-vis someone who doesn't believe that they're actually true, I think. So the kind of the prior question that your thesis seems to be founded upon is of course that Christianity and religious viewpoints are actually metaphysically false, and then you go on to say, but let's not chuck the baby out with the bathwater in terms of the sort of meanings and sense of things that are useful for how we live our life that we can nevertheless get out of the kind of stories that are told in religious texts. Am I reading you correctly?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, I'm not trying to dissuade the doctrinally believing Christian necessarily. I mean, my greater concern is for those in the atheist community to persuade that perspective that there is a spirituality available and that religion can contribute to that spirituality. So although I do state the reasons in the book and some parts quite assertively for the atheist position, I certainly think that church in mission needs to understand why the atheist community has got to where it has, far more than it ever seems to do so. So the church seems not to amend its doctrinal message, its gospel of salvation, as the evangelicals interpret it, at all. And the atheist sea is out there and comprehending there's actually very little engagement. But I would, whilst I therefore want
to... Are you saying then that for the Christian church to, you know, really engage with atheists, we have to basically say there's no God and we are... Because it sounds a bit like you're saying...
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it needs to have greater understanding of the people who do feel that, and why they've got there, and how they've got there. And I find very little engagement with that understanding in the Christian church. So, you know, I go along to a very famous evangelical church close to where I live in Bristol. Extremely nice people there. But the message bears no relevance to the journey of the majority of the population of the city and how they've got to the atheist conclusion they've currently got to. It's kind of two parallel lines that will never meet. So I'm just arguing for a greater empathy from the church towards the atheist position. But coming back to what Peter says, I mean, the challenge, I suppose, from my side, and I put it with respect, but it is still a challenge, saying, well, what does the literal part of the belief add? So, for example, if we take the story which I take in the book of Christ throwing the market out of the temple, in my view, whether I believe that literally or not, doesn't add any value to it, because as a story, it has huge value, in my view, of the role of the market in human life, that there may be areas that are holy to humanity that should not be subject to profit and price and market trading. Love would be one of them, friendship would be another. We could argue that education and health are other ones. Now, as myth, as story, it has huge meaning. And I actually think that's fair in the context of Christ's own teachings, which were hugely parable and story. So literalism, I'm arguing, doesn't add anything. And in many cases, as in the Hindu religion of Ram and Sita, the myth of Ram rescuing Sita is a wonderful myth of somebody going to any lengths to rescue the one that they love. But the literalizing of it by putting two dolls in a little doll's house and going worshipping them and putting bits of orange in front of them, frankly, in my view, trivializes it rather than realizing its greatness, its splendor.
Well, of course, if you have the Christian understanding of Jesus, then something like Jesus casting out the from the market in the temple and so on, you would also see as actually giving you a window into an expression of the character of God, that it adds to your information about the Creator and his intent to actually relate to us. So it's not that you don't get any truths out of it if you don't think that it's real, but if you do think it's real, you do think that it is giving you actual information about a reality that if you don't think the story is true and you don't think Jesus is who Christians think he was, then obviously you don't think that that story is giving you information about the nature of ultimate reality. So I think there is a difference between the two perspectives.
But, you know, when Jesus speaks and he says, there was a woman who lost a coin, for example. Now, are we to believe that there really was a woman who lost a coin?
Absolutely not. I mean,
well, you see, absolutely not. He's teaching a parable, but it's a fair interpretation for some that maybe there was a woman who lost a coin.
Yeah.
But is it important?
Well, there, because we're both agreeing that the correct interpretation of that story is that it's a parable that doesn't rest upon the literal truth of it. But there are plenty of things that whether or not you think the story is true or not, the correct interpretation of what's being claimed by Jesus, by the original disciples, by Christians, is that the event is actually true and tells us something real about ultimate reality. So I don't think there's a sort of strict analogy between those two things
I suppose
that you can draw there.
My question as well is, why choose Christianity? I mean, on your basis, isn't any story, whether it be Harry Potter or whatever, equally valid for getting good moral precepts and ways of looking at the world from? I mean, is it just because Christianity is, as it were, still has cultural currency that you feel it should be reinterpreted in this way?
Oh, no, I don't think it has any prime place. I think there is a lot of other literature and a lot of other spiritualities that generate great moral truths, and I quote several in the book. So some of the great films, some of the great novels, Tolstoy's novels, current novelists, so on and so forth. There are great sources of value and virtue. I quote, for example, Christopher Rice's work on T.S. Eliot, where he's talking about prejudice in T.S. Eliot. And I think his work on prejudice is, frankly, more morally inspiring than anything in the Bible that I can find on prejudice. In fact, one could argue the Bible is hugely prejudiced. It's prejudiced in favor of some and against others. So there isn't as strong a message challenging prejudice in the Bible as there is in, Christopher Rick's interpretation of T.S. Eliot. So there's a lot of literature out there. All I'm saying is that the great religious literatures, which have been discarded by the current militant atheist society, should not be so discarded. They should be examined. They should be taken with an open mind, because they do have great virtue. So I'm elevating virtue, if you like, rather than doctrine, because I agree with what Peter's saying. You know, if one does accept the literal nature of the incarnation, but not the literal nature of the parable story, there is, of course, a spectrum there. What about Jonah and the whale, you see? I mean, I've been at Christian conventions where there have been furious arguments between these who think it's a parable and those who stormed out because it must be believed literally. So there is a spectrum here as to where it is.
Sure.
But the belief that these things are literal only helps by adding this spiral of doctrinal interpretations, the house of doctrine. And as far as I can see, the house of doctrine leads us nowhere.
Well, here I think is where I would want to start digging into the more fundamental philosophical issues. Because if you are taking a metaphysically naturalistic worldview and then saying, but we can have a spiritual life, we can have meanings, we can have values that we value on top of that without having to believe in some kind of real God or whatever. That, of course, raises basic metaphysical issues like, can there be such a thing as objective meanings, values, purposes in the absence of a theistic reality? Are those atheists like Nietzsche and Sartre and so on who would argue, given that there's no God, then there really is no given purpose for life, no real meaning for life, no objective difference between what we happen to value and what some other culture happens to value? We're just different, and it's not that one of us is actually wrong about the objective facts of the moral matter. Are those kind of atheists right about that? Because from my perspective, I kind of think that they are consistently working out the consequences of a naturalistic worldview. So I'm kind of drawn to them because of that, just as much as I'm drawn to you because you're saying, no, but we don't want to chuck the baby out with the bathwater. We are spiritual beings. We do value things. We do need a sense of purpose and so on. But I think my question is, yes, but don't what we actually need is a sense of objective, real purpose rather than just a sense of what's meaningful for us.
And yeah. I'll get to your answer in a moment because we're coming up to a break, and I'm sure you're ready to respond to Peter's question. We're getting into the meat of the subject now as we ask, can an atheist believe in meaning? Jeff Crocker says, atheists of the stripes of, you know, Richard Dawkins, etc., shouldn't chuck out the baby with the bathwater when it comes to religion. We can reinterpret religion as myth to give a sense of meaning. And you've been talking about spiritual atheism, which to me sounds like a contradiction in terms, and possibly to many people would. But we'll get you to expand on that as well in a moment, Jeff. So you're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. My guests today, Peter S. Williams and Jeff Crocker. As we ask, can an atheist believe in meaning?
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
I'm Justin Brierley, your host through till 4 o'clock this afternoon. Welcome along this Saturday afternoon. And with me here in the studio, Peter S. Williams and Jeff Crocker. Peter S. Williams is a Christian philosopher and apologist, author of many books, including, perhaps pertinently to today's discussion, I Wish I Could Believe in Meaning. Jeff is a former Christian, now an atheist, but he's concerned that atheism can entail a lack of meaning and value on a certain view of it, and that we do need to be looking to religion as providing potentially a sort of mythical aspect that allows us to draw out meaning from the stories and the sort of traditions of religion. Well, we're looking at that today. Jeff has written down his thoughts in a book called An Enlightened Philosophy, and I'll put a link to that with the podcast of this programme, which you can find at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Gentlemen, so just as we sort of concluded that last section there, Jeff, Peter Williams was asking, ultimately, you know, Nietzsche, Sartre, some of these great atheist philosophers sort of traced the ultimate conclusion of there being no ultimate God, no ultimate sort of transcendent reality, as being that, well, there is therefore no objective purpose, no objective values, no objective meaning in the world. And I mean, the question that struck me as Peter was explaining that was that it sometimes feels to me a bit like, in this, you're trying to rescue something of what you did have as a Christian and sort of transplant it into an atheistic framework where it perhaps sits a little uncomfortably, because at the end of the day, if as an atheist, I mean, would you describe yourself as a materialist atheist, that you actually believe there is nothing ultimately at an ultimate level than physical matter and processes? I mean, if that is true, then how do we get from that to value, meaning, and all the rest of it? It seems to me that you need an extra level of reality to make sense of those kinds of concepts.
Well, I think that an intellectual position always retains doubt and should always retain doubt. So I have doubt in my own intellectual position. But as far as my hypothesis is at the moment, it's close to an atheist position which regards the world as material. Your question, therefore, as to how does one generate a metaphysical from the physical, my answer to that is that we simply don't know. Neuroscience hasn't got us to that point yet of being able to understand, for example, even how an idea is formed in the human brain, how it's lodged in that brain, how it can be transmitted through my mouth by verbal means to your ear, go into your brain, and whether you agree with the idea or not, you're free to do either, the idea is then replicated. Or listeners to your show, now I don't know how many listeners you have, but perhaps tens of thousands of people get the idea replicated in their mind. The idea is multiplied tens of thousands of times without any increase in physical mass in the universe. So therefore the challenge to the ultra materialist is, how do you account for that metaphysical increase of meaning and value without any increase in mass? Now, it could be that the neurons reconfigure in a certain way, but the answer is, at the moment, we simply don't know. So we have to live accepting a huge area of ignorance. Now, that doesn't mean that we should let the ignorance continue forever, and neurological research is extremely welcome. But in our present position, we don't know. So coming, therefore, to the question of ultimates, of absolutes, of objective existences, I fully accept the challenge that the position that I'm currently in, and I have to add that a lot of people who are atheists but who ascribe to any value at all are in, and there are a lot of people in that position, has no absolute, ultimate, objective justification for it. Where does it therefore come from is, as you say, a huge question. I don't mind answering that question by saying I don't know, because actually that is the current truth, I don't know. But let me put in some alternative challenges. That is, how absolute are the values that come out of religion? So, for example, you can take the issue of capital punishment, where religious views differ greatly. In the United States, they continue capital punishment and simply think that it's written into the Bible as part of God's law. In Europe, we've thrown out capital punishment, in my view, correctly, not only for pragmatic reasons that you could end up executing somebody who's innocent, but also for humane reasons that society should behave better than somebody who has killed somebody else. If it's applying a higher virtue, then it should live that higher virtue. So the religious position can be unclear about something as important as capital punishment, as indeed it is on many other moral issues. So it doesn't give us any absolute. And people change their position during the course of their lives, even as believing Christians. Whether women should be ordained and so on, what is the acceptability of homosexual lifestyles within Christian understanding? These are great questions, but there is no absolute answer to them. And I think there is a kind of urge within the Christian community to establish an absolute. There seems to be a sort of frenzied need to have absolute objective statements about everything. I question whether they really add anything, because again, if you come to some of the great Christ statements, for example, the Sermon on the Mount, where the virtues are celebrated, this isn't based upon anything absolute. It's based upon a statement of the intrinsic attraction of the virtues of justice, of the virtues of mercy, of the virtues of love themselves. Now, when one starts to look at the universe and say, how much is objective and where is their purpose, I would argue that in the constellation of the physical, I see no purpose at all. I don't see any purpose in the way that the universe is expanding, or the planets are rotating, or everything's spinning, or the various particles are floating through space, or the animal species live. I don't see a purpose written in it, other than mere survival. Therefore, I think that we are conning ourselves if we're looking for an external statement of purpose, that the real statement of purpose is generated from within the human. And again, I would claim that this does ring true with certain of Christ's philosophies. For example, he said that it's out of somebody's inner being that flow rivers of living water. It isn't that they're imposed from outside. They're generated from within the person.
Well, Peter, so essentially, meaning comes from within. There is no sort of outside standard by which we sort of can grasp onto, and the universe itself doesn't display a sense of purpose or direction in that sense.
Yeah, well, I think that's the, I mean, in a sense, that's a clear articulation from Jeff of what I would take to be the standard naturalistic worldview, implying that there is no objective purpose and there are no absolute values. I think this thing of going from, well, because people disagree about certain matters, therefore there's no fact of the matter, there's only the disagreement, I think that's a problematical move. Just because there's no agreement upon what the facts of the matter are doesn't entail that there are no facts of the matter. On a naturalistic worldview, it seems to me that all you have is the disagreeing opinions, and then you say that there are no absolutes. So, of course, both Christians, religious people, and non-religious people disagree about lots of moral questions, but at least on a religious view, there are facts of the matter, one way or another, to be possibly discovered, which make ethical debate sort of serious and worthwhile rather than simply an exchange of opinions. And also, what about clear cases? What about the Holocaust was evil, or torturing a small child just for the fun of it is wrong? It would seem to me that on the naturalistic view, just as much as on any issue where people are disagreeing, so for that kind of clear, surely, case where our intuitions want to say, no, that really is true, and we, even across our metaphysical divide, would want to agree on that, I'm sure, that a naturalistic worldview doesn't give you any way of claiming that that is a fact. It's just an opinion, just as much as any of the opinions that are involved in those matters that people disagree about.
Yeah, well, I follow you a lot of the way with that. But you see, I think that if one says the Holocaust is evil, as you do and I do, and if you say torturing a child is evil, which you do and I do, then how you get to that position actually doesn't terribly matter, because we both agree what we would do in those situations. We agree on the moral imperative.
What do you do with someone who disagrees with you? What about Hitler?
Well,
upon what basis do you tell him that he's wrong and he should desist
upon
from...
Upon the simple basis of arbitrary choice.
So it's just an arbitrary choice on your part to tell Hitler. So there isn't actually any meaning behind it, ultimately? Or
there is a meaning behind it, ultimately. There is a meaning of the value of human life and of human values. Because, you see, one could say to the theist, OK, you object to the Holocaust because you believe in God, and God sets these values. But what if your God doesn't exist? Do you then not condemn the Holocaust? And indeed, this God who does exist, what did he do about the Holocaust? He did nothing. So the people went into the valley of the shadow of death, and he didn't do anything about it. Now, you know, he did nothing about the bubonic plague. So here is the God who's the father of us all, who cares, and all the rest of it. But when humanity hits the bubonic plague and a third of the European population die in severe agony, God makes no move. The only salvation for that comes through the Enlightenment, through medical science, which discovers what the bacteria is and countermands it. So our current position owes far more to the Enlightenment and technology than it does to this God who's gone AWOL.
But then, of course, if you're raising a classical problem of evil against the existence of God there and saying God would be objectively wrong not to intervene on these occasions, he didn't, therefore God can't be good or can't exist or something like this, that very argument, of course, is presupposing this notion of objective wrongness, which on a metaphysically naturalistic view, that there is no such thing as only an opinion that you happen to have and that other people may disagree with, but that has no sort of grounding in reality, as it were. Whereas at least if you're saying, no, I think there are some things that are objectively right and wrong, a coherent way of explaining that is to root them in the character of a transcendent personal being who grounds our moral obligations and prescriptions, such as we know
about. Well, it doesn't ground them in a reliable way. That's the trouble I have. So there is absolutely no absolute about his statement, as we've already agreed, about various important moral issues. So the question as to what is objective in this universe, it seems to me, is very difficult once you get outside the physical. So the physical can be seen to be objective, but even Newtonian gravitational force It clearly obeys the mathematics of Newton's formulae, but how is it generated? We just don't know. It is a metaphysical. Maxwell's electromagnetic field, the same. Probability, the same. There seems to be an irreducible stochastic element in this world that generates probability distributions. We don't know how that happens. So there are a lot of things in the metaphysical world that we don't know. And the value and virtue join those as far as I can see, because you're right. I mean, I don't have a source explanation for them. I claim that you don't either, because your source explanation is a God who one has to prove his existence first of all, and that's very tricky.
Peter's been employing is an argument for God.
It's a classic argument.
It's not presupposing the existence of God in order for the argument to work. It's saying, if you want your objective values, that the Holocaust is evil and that torturing a child for fun is wrong, then the only way of grounding that, of being able to explain that, is in a transcendent realm of values, which simply doesn't exist on an atheistic worldview if all there is matter. It has to be grounded in something.
Why does it have to be grounded in anything?
Because, well, Peter...
Well, I mean, there are a number of different arguments in this field, but, for example, if you say, let's think about the nature of what an objective moral value would be. What type of thing is it? Well, it wouldn't seem to be a material thing, so it must be an immaterial thing of some kind. Like an idea or a concept would be on a dualist view of mind. So where do you lodge it in reality? Certainly not within a metaphysically materialistic reality. There is no transcendent mind to put it in. Moral values seem to be things that we are obligated to obey. And yet how can anything non-personal or purely physical or anything non-personal obligate behavior or prescribe behavior? So that the obligatory, prescriptive, ideal kind of nature of what an objective moral value would be, were it to exist, would seem to imply that its best explanation would be in terms of something transcendent, non-physical, personal, prescribing, obligating.
Yes, I mean,
in respect to us.
Yes, you're speculating an explanation, and I don't object to that, but I would say it is a speculative explanation. And my challenge to you would be that when you yourself, we've just been discussing together various moral issues, you're actually not saying, okay, I am against the Holocaust. Why are you against the Holocaust? Because God says I should be against the Holocaust. Why am I favor of an inclusive attitude to homosexuals? I don't know whether you are, but if you are, is that because God says so? Well, because there are other people who are saying God says the very opposite. So in that sense, I would challenge that you're actually not calling upon this objective God in order to express your moral persuasions. And if you are, there are others who take exactly the opposite view from the same objective God. So where's the objectivity gone?
Well, my argument the moral argument that I'm making is not in terms of how do I arrive at my knowledge of moral truths. It is rather saying, given my knowledge of at least some clear moral truths that seem to be objective, if you take those as being true objective moral truths, how do you explain their existence? What type of realities are there, and what is the best metaphysical explanation of there being such realities? So I'm not saying I know that the Holocaust was wrong because God's told me, or the Bible says don't murder, and I believe it's the word of God, or anything like that. I'm saying it seems intuitively obvious to me that the Holocaust was wrong, that that's an objective moral fact. Okay, what do I do with the fact that I see there are objective moral facts? What metaphysical view of reality makes such a thing as an objective moral fact that obligates and prescribes my behaviour at home? It certainly doesn't seem to be a metaphysically naturalistic, materialistic world view. And certainly seems to be much more coherent on a theistic worldview.
Well, but I'd say that you're using Enlightenment rationality to want to get an explanation of spirituality. And I think that evangelical doctrine has done that all the way through. You know, there's if that, therefore this. All of sin that comes short of the glory of God. Christ died to forgive sins, therefore this. It's all QED. It's like a little mathematical formula. And it's Enlightenment rationality falsely applied to spirituality. And when it comes down to it, if you and I have an agenda for social justice, for example, today, and if we share that agenda, as I suspect by sort of feel somehow we probably do, the fact that you say you get it from God and the fact that I say I've got it but I don't know where I got it from doesn't actually make a lot of difference to the objective of pursuing social justice, because you're saying you got it from God or from an external objective source. I respect that. I don't want to actually attack that in you. I am saying I think that it's subject to question, and therefore there's a weakness in your foundation, as there is a weakness in my foundation, because I'm admitting I don't know where I get it from, but it's humanly attractive and I want to vote for it. So the divine is endogenous for me, but there is a divine. So grace and kindness and justice. And André Comte-Sponville, a French philosopher, I'm a great fan of his. He produced a beautiful book called A Short Treatise on the Classical Virtues, and he goes through 18 such virtues and celebrates them. But he is a totally atheist, and in fact a deterministic atheist. Nevertheless, I can celebrate those virtues and live by them, even though I don't know where they come from. Yes. You celebrate them because you say you know where they came from. Well, I respect your certainty,
but I agree with
you about the realities.
Yeah, and again, there's a large overlap here, but it's more a case of I'm saying I like you, accept them, and I think I know where they come from, rather than I accept them because I think of where they come from. I certainly plead guilty to trying to mount a rational argument for God from morality, but in terms of... the dialectic of a debate on, you know, which worldview is true, I don't think it will do simply to say, oh, what you're doing there is arguing about something spiritual, and by definition, spiritual things can't be argued about, so I'm not going to interact with
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that.
I mean, in what sense...
I'm happy to engage in that.
I'd be interested in your definition of spiritual, because if on an ultimate level you are a materialist, as you seem to have said, Jeff... What is this spiritual that you refer to? Is it just these ideas that can't be explained and therefore come under the category of spiritual within an atheist framework?
What is non-physical? So what is intellectual? What is emotional? What is spiritual? Where are feelings? Where are values? Where are points of view? Where are experiences? In other words, all I'm arguing is that there is a huge metaphysical dimension to being a human being and to being a human society.
Is it purely something that arises from... Is it purely dependent upon the material, though? I'm assuming you're not saying there's a physical realm and a spiritual realm, because
that's not
atheism, is
no,
it?
No, no, no. Well, I'm not necessarily wanting to ascribe to some sort of standard atheism. The great debate that Roy Peacock followed in his wonderful book called Flesh in the Age of Reason follows from David Hume onwards, the question as to whether there is a separate soul. So Hume's response was that there is not a separate soul, because he then concluded that this is a question of eternity, that there isn't a separate metaphysical that will survive at the death of our physical being. Well, okay, I actually do assent to that, because I don't actually think that the ideas I have lodged in my mind now, unless I write them down on paper, which is why I wrote the book, or the feelings I have now are going to survive my physical existence. That's what I happen to think. I don't know, but that's my best hypothesis at the moment. Nevertheless, what I'm saying to the real reductionist is, hang on, that doesn't mean that whilst we're alive we don't have a soul, because while we're alive, in some way that we don't understand, the physical generates the metaphysical. When the physical dies, maybe the metaphysical gets switched off and doesn't live forever. But who knows? What we do know, which is far more important, is that while we're alive, the metaphysical is there, and there is a human soul.
I'd like to just ask a clarifying question, if I may, here, because previously it seemed to me that you were saying that you were subscribing to a metaphysically naturalistic, materialistic worldview, that there is nothing supernatural or non-physical that exists. But now it seems you're saying that what you actually think is that there is a material physical universe that generates the existence of non-physical supernatural realities. So you're not a naturalist. You're a supernaturalist, but one who doesn't believe in God or an afterlife.
Well, it depends what your use of the word supernatural is.
Well, non-physical.
Usually the word supernatural in Christian terms is meant to be a contradiction of what the natural physical process would be. In other words, Christ can walk on water and ascend to heaven.
Right, no, I'm not using it in...
It's a miracle.
Miraculous. I'm using it in the philosophical sense of not within the standard description of a metaphysically naturalistic worldview.
I'm suggesting that the physical human... generates a metaphysical of intellect, of emotion, and of spirituality. I don't know how that operates, as we said at the beginning of the discussion, because neuroscience hasn't got us anywhere near there. I mean, neuroscience is at the elemental position of cartography, roughly knowing where the continents of the world are, and that's all. And we just don't know. I mean, the human brain seems to understand everything except itself.
There are, of course, philosophers like Keith Ward who would say, and it will never give us a physical explanation because you can't get there philosophically from a material to the immaterial aspects, and that is precisely the arguments that they would give for the existence of God. You're saying, well, we haven't found out, we can't explain it at the moment. Others are saying... Actually, there's your proof, if you wanted proof of God, that we do not live in a purely materialistic universe because these things are simply cannot cohere together, the existence of these very this metaphysical realm that you're talking about. I mean, there isn't... You've exactly outlined the fact that a physical realm giving rise to a non-physical realm is a contradiction in terms, and so... I don't see why we should think that we will find an explanation eventually in neuroscience.
Well, I don't think it is a contradiction in terms necessarily, and I don't think it proves God in the way you said. It opens up a possible case for a hypothesis of God, sure. It does open up a possible case for a hypothesis of God. But there are so many other factors that argue against the existence of God that the alternative hypothesis that these are generated by the physical is a valid hypothesis.
But it's interesting that the one you've brought up, which is the problem of evil, kind of rests on, interestingly, another thing that you also take for granted, which is this idea of there being objective standards of right and wrong, justice, etc., and that a just God wouldn't allow these things to happen. But you don't get this objective standard, as Peter pointed out earlier in the programme, without having God in the first place to ground that objective standard of right and wrong.
Yes, I don't have an objective standard. I fully admit that.
Oh, challenge. So you are a relativist as far as morality, then?
Yes.
So...
Well, I have my own convictions, and I would argue for those convictions, for
example. Why would you argue for them?
But that's where the unknown is. And the God of the gaps, who say there's an unknown here, let's posit God. Well, that's one way of doing it. But the humbler way, I think, is to live in the uncertainty and to say, actually, I don't know, but I still ascribe to mercy. So where does mercy come from? I mean, is mercy a Darwinian adaptation because it's for the survival of the fittest? Is it a maladaptation because actually it's going to lead to us being wiped out if we're not harsh enough with other people? Is it from an external God? Is it from a metaphysical in the universe we don't know where it's from? Or is it generated from within us? I just don't know. And I don't think any of us know. But does it matter if we wish to ascribe to mercy?
Well, I think it matters if we wish to ascribe to mercy being an objective reality, that ascribe to the idea that we ought to be merciful. Darwinian explanations of how come we feel or believe that we want to be merciful, or that grounded in perhaps being merciful has been advantageous to survival in the past or whatever, or it being a maladaption or whatever. But I think issues about how come we believe or feel or have maybe a tendency to act in certain ways, none of that scratches the actual question of, but is it true that we really ought to act in this way?
Well, I can't see, but you put true and ought together, really, because one's an is statement and the other ought statement are very different very different issues. I'm prepared to argue for mercy, and I don't know where it comes from, but I think it leads to a more beautiful humanity. Now,
but all of this is from your subjective point of view. To you, it's more beautiful, but to Stalin, it isn't more beautiful. On what basis do you say Stalin ought to
choose? So, you know, the human race can look at Stalin and they can look at a merciful existence and they can choose. And if those who want to choose Stalin, good luck to them. Those who want to choose mercy, let's live together.
You remind me of Jean-Paul Sartre's lecture on humanism, where he says mankind is condemned to be free, that we just have to choose. But nothing that we choose actually fundamentally in the end objectively matters.
Yeah, because the God belief doesn't necessarily generate mercy. Islam's God isn't as merciful as the Christian God.
Well, that's right, but that's going from a certain theology to certain values that one might build out of that. Whereas, of course, the moral argument was going from a common recognition of values and then asking how do we then explain them, whether that God that is the metaphysical explanation of the reality of objective values is a God who's revealed himself in any particular religious tradition, and if so, which one. That would be a whole secondary question down the line, but simply to argue for a kind of theism from the reality of objective values, I think that's a very significant step one in this conversation.
We're going to have to take a quick break again, gents, and we'll wrap up our thoughts in a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable as we ask, can an atheist believe in meaning? And Jeff Crocker's been giving his view as an atheist, former Christian, of how he does think that, as it were, the case for having meaning and value in our life and how religion contributes to that on an atheistic framework. And Peter S. Williams asking some of the questions today of Jeff on whether that makes sense at an ultimate level. But your thoughts welcome as well. I'll give out the ways of doing that in a short moment's time as we conclude our programme in a moment's time here on Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking. Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Well, my Christian guest in the studio today, Peter S. Williams, joins me again next week. He's going to be talking about his new book, Understanding Jesus, and he's going to be answering the questions of a few sceptics. We're going to have a Muslim guest who's going to be asking a question on Jesus, an atheist, and a Christian who just has a question on some biblical aspects of Jesus. So it should be a good one next week if you want to tune back in for that, Understanding Jesus with my guest Peter S. Williams at the same time next week. Don't forget, a little later on in this show, we'll be getting some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. So stick around for that. We'll be getting some of your views on the William Lane Craig show of last week when he took some of your questions. And by the way, we've tried to rectify the fact that the last 10 minutes of the podcast on that occasion was missing of some of the feedback at the end of the show. So if you want to re-download that show, you should find that the missing audio is now there if you're interested in finding out what was said right at the end there. But the main gist of the show, of course, was all there with William Lane Craig. Let's get back into today's show as we conclude this question. Can an atheist believe in meaning?
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Jeff Crocker is a former Christian. His book, An Enlightened Philosophy, sort of talks about the way that he believes we can retain a strong conviction in the value of religion, even if we are an atheist and interpret it as a myth. So can we believe in anything is the subtitle of Jeff's book. Can an atheist believe in anything? Well, Peter S. Williams is a Christian philosopher who's done quite a bit of work in this area and has come essentially to the conclusion that on an atheistic framework, nihilism is the ultimate outworking of that, that there is no ultimate existential meaning to life, and that anything that we do have, I suppose, Peter, might be a way of putting it, is illusory in some sense.
Purely subjective.
Subjective. Yeah. Let's finish off, gentlemen, in this last section, just a statement, really, of where you stand then as we finish up the programme. Because there's been some really interesting to-ing and fro-ing. To start with you, Jeff, what do you remain convinced? I mean, you've spoken a lot about the fact that you don't know where stuff comes from. As an atheist, you don't know why there is a metaphysical realm which you apprehend, and which I can imagine a lot of your atheist colleagues would disagree with you on, that they'd say you've misunderstood what this is, perhaps. But you seem to say, at least for the time that a human being is alive, there is a non-physical, metaphysical realm to them that we need to have sort of things like religion and stories to be able to create meaning in that sort of spiritual space. Has anything that Peter said today made you reappraise that, or do you feel that this just is the way it is, whether or not we understand it?
Well, firstly, I think that the militant atheists do acknowledge a metaphysical dimension to human life because they themselves are trading in intellectual argument and ideas. So they are participating in a metaphysical element to being a human being. I'm not really intent on a combative argument to, although I'm happy for the debate, but I'm not combative towards Peter's position, actually. I mean, my main thrust is that current secular society, which has found itself in the atheist agenda, really does need some grand narratives. It really does need to think about the virtues. It really does need to think about how it wants to live, because physicalism leads us to a consumer society and ends up being rather reductionist of what the human potential really is. And therefore, I'm saying that if the atheist position will acknowledge that it needs an account of the metaphysical, and if the religious contribution to that, instead of being doctrine, which I do criticize as being insignificant, emphasizes the myth interpretation and meaning of its messages, then I think there is a huge synthesis to be explored. And I'm not coming from some exact position.
No.
I'm just saying that here is a synthesis for us to jointly explore.
On that basis, we can get on better with each other if we have these meta-narratives, etc. But ultimately, there's no ultimate end in sight. There's no kind of thing towards which we're progressing. You know, it really is just a case of making it up as we go along. And in that sense, because obviously on the Christian meta-narrative, you talk about meta-narratives, there is a grand purpose, a grand design. God has a plan of salvation, redemption, renewal, and all the rest of it that's involved in Christianity. To me, that might give someone more of a sense of ultimate meaning and purpose than your one, which is really about grab whatever meta-narrative you can, because at the end of the day, without that, we're kind of floating in a sea of existential nihilism.
You are pejoritizing my position pretty strongly there. I don't think we are making it up as we go along. I think there is a grand debate about what the virtues are, which literature, including religious literature, explores, celebrates, outlines, and so on for us. And we should join in that exploratory journey. You can pejoritize it and make it up as you go along if you like, but I think that trivializes great literature. And I think that when one looks at the Sermon on the Mount, what is the purpose of the Sermon on the Mount? The purpose is for humanity to be able to discover and live in a blessed life. And I think that blessedness is open to somebody who happens not to believe in an exogenous God just as much as it is to somebody who does. You claim that a belief in God brings this purpose to you, but I don't see the enunciation of that purpose either in the created world, where the purpose seems to be very mixed up, if there is any purpose at all, or indeed for humanity. I don't see that it brings purpose. The purpose is generated from within us. How do I wish to live? What kind of contribution do I wish to make? How do I want to relate to the other human beings around me in this society? Those are the purposes, and they're not forced on me by an outside agency. They're generated from within. Now, you think they're forced on you by an outside agency. I think that understates who you are.
Peter.
Well, I've found it a fascinating discussion, and I hope it's come across that there's lots of points of commonality between us, and I think I really empathise with your struggle with or grasping with these concepts of meaning and purpose and so on. For me, I think it's true to say that on a metaphysically naturalistic worldview, you would have to say, as you did, that there is a distinction between facts, which are purely physical things, and values, which are just subjective choices or opinions that we make. Yeah. I think the only rational explanation of there being objective values that are facts, but not physical facts, is to transcend a naturalistic worldview, to say there is something that's non-physical in reality. And ultimately, for me, the best explanation of these obligating, prescribing facts that are values would have to be in a personal transcendent ground of obligation and moral prescription, which is God. And I don't think you can have one without the other. But so in a sense, I'm with those atheists like Sartre and Nietzsche who would say, look, no God, everything's just physical and so on. That means there are no real objective values and purposes and meanings and so on. But on the other hand, I would much prefer that atheists out there and naturalists out there follow their instinct about the importance of values and meaning and purpose in life, and let's go on and fight social injustice because that's something we really ought to do, than that they're consistent, you know, that philosophical level in that sense. I don't see how you square the circle, but I much prefer that you tilt the balance in the way that you are than that you were going through life like Friedrich Nietzsche.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, both for being on the programme with me today. Thank you, Jeff, for coming in. Excellent. And if you want to find out more about Jeff's book, it's available now. You can order it from his website, which is anenlightenedphilosophy.com, I think.
It is, yeah.
And we'll put the link, of course, to that with the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Peter S. Williams returns next week, so we look forward to having you back again then, Peter. And if you'd like to comment on today's programme, why not get in touch? It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also phone and leave me a voicemail message if you would like, 08456 52 52 52, and select the option for Unbelievable, and I'll happily play out some of those next week as well. So thank you for being with me today, gentlemen, and I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Well, we're going to be hearing some of your thoughts in just a moment's time as we look at some of your feedback to the past few weeks of programming.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, fascinating programme. Peter joins us again next week, as I said. And he, of course, is involved. Damaris, one of the organisations he works for, are involved in bringing the William Lane Craig Reasonable Faith Tour to UK shores. And Peter S. Williams will actually be joining Bill for a rather late addition to the schedule. But Bill Craig will be debating the existence of God at the Cambridge Union, the hallowed halls of the Cambridge Union, the oldest debating society, I think, in the world. And they're going to be teaming up together in a different type of debate format to the others that are on the bill, where they'll be opposite two atheists, Arif Ahmed and Andrew Copson. So that'll be interesting. If you are a member of the Cambridge Union, you'll have the privilege of being able to attend that debate. But as I've said, there are three public debates open to anyone, whether you're a member of the Cambridge Union or not, that you can get to across the country, starting, of course, in London, here where we broadcast from, here at Premier Christian Radio. You can join us at Westminster Central Hall on Monday, the 17th of October, and that's when Bill will be opposite Stephen Law, atheist philosopher, who is standing in for Polly Toynbee, who pulled out a month or two back. We expect a great debate between them, though, and that'll be a wonderful time to really put the arguments to the test that we were hearing from Bill last week on the programme when he joined me for a Q&A session with some of your listener questions. So premier.org.uk/Craig to book in for that debate, or indeed the debates going on in Manchester and Birmingham. Birmingham is with atheist philosopher Peter Millikan, and in Manchester, atheist scientist Peter Atkins. So it should be a great time had by all. Lectures also in Southampton. Southampton is on the resurrection of Jesus. Cambridge, you can get along to the lecture there if you're in the Cambridge area, on responding to Hawking and the grand design and whether God can be seen as the cause of the universe. I'll be chairing that lecture, so it'd be great to welcome you there as well in Cambridge. Look for the details of the tour at the website premier.org.uk/Craig, and just a final mention of that large that big Apologetics Day conference at Westminster Chapel on Saturday the 22nd of October, featuring Bill, but also John Lennox, Gary Habermas and Peter J. Williams. Will be a great day, I'm sure. So that's the place to go. Now, if you are interested as well, and you haven't yet got your hands on a copy of it, can I mention something else? Unbelievable Conference on DVD has been landing on people's doormats, and I've got a whole stash of them in the office here, and you could get your hands on one too. Here's a little something we put together to advertise this elsewhere in our schedule here on Premier Christian Radio.
Get into the public discussion, because if we don't, those that say there is no God, win by default.
Over 9 hours of teaching, 5 key speakers, all on one DVD. Unbelievable, the conference. Get honest answers to tough questions at premier.org.uk/DVD.
Oh, that's exciting, isn't it? Well done, Brad, who's in charge of producing our commercials for us, and he's done a great job on there. Oh, sounds like the end of the world or something if you don't buy that DVD. But great stuff. And the voice, of course, you hear at the beginning of that is John Lennox, who's one of the key contributors to the conference that we held back in May. So if you want to see, as it says, over 9 hours of footage from that conference and the various speakers that were involved there, David Robertson, Jay Smith, David Instone Brewer, Mark Rock, and John Lennox, and the various seminars that they held and the Q&A that followed, do get along to premier.org.uk/DVD. You can get hold of that DVD, own it, 3 discs worth of material there. Speaking of David Instone Brewer, who I just mentioned, he's actually appearing tonight at Gunnersbury Baptist Church in a debate going on there from 7:30 p.m. doors at 7. If you want to get along to that, he's going to be debating Kenneth Humphreys, who some may know as the author of a book called Jesus Never Existed, and a website of the same name. A kind of very hardline skeptic when it comes to the reliability of scripture. So you can expect the kind of debate they'll have as they look at the question, is the Bible historically reliable? So if you're interested and you've got your evening free tonight, listening on Saturday today, why not get along there tonight? Gunnersbury Baptist Church, Wellesley Road, W4 4BE, in London. Should be a really interesting debate. And we might be playing out some of the audio from that debate in a few weeks' time. Right, some of your feedback would be good to get to, wouldn't it? Let's go to mentioning the DVD. Thank you, Philip in Bridlington, who wanted to say, thanks for my copy of the conference DVD. I've just worked my way through all the seminars, one of the benefits of not being in full-time employment at the moment. I'm sure the information contained will prove to be a great resource for me in the future, and I'll be revisiting the various seminars frequently. I particularly appreciated the input of David Robertson on how do I make the case for faith. David is a very engaging speaker, and I enjoyed his humour as well as his insight. And Jay Smith on his thoughts of how, as Christians, we should approach Islam. I have to admit, I knew very little about Islam before watching the DVD, but I've now been encouraged to learn more. It was also nice to put faces to some of the speakers who have appeared on the Unbelievable debates. Thank you also for the additional CD I received. Not necessary, but it has been most gratefully received. Thank you very much, Philip. Glad you're enjoying that. If you've got hold of yours, do let me know how you're finding it. Now, last week we had William Lane Craig join me here, and he was taking some of the listener questions that I'd asked you to submit, and many of you did, and we just got to a fraction of them really, but a number of them were in regard to the Kalam cosmological argument, which is always one of the primary arguments Bill brings out in his debates against atheists. The idea that the fact that the universe is finite, had a beginning in time and space, well, that time and space had a beginning in the Big Bang, as it were, and the fact that nothing comes into existence without a cause is evidence for the existence of God as the first cause of the universe. Justin Shiva was one of the people whose question I asked, and he says, Craig's response to my question on time and intentional action was an interesting one. Craig doesn't believe that intentional actions require a temporal realm, which, of course, is important in the sense of if God intended to produce the universe, does that make sense in the context of there not being any time before the Big Bang? But you say he thinks that intentions and the actions that are a result of those intentions could possibly be simultaneously. He asks us to think of a person dangling from a cliff, hanging onto a tree root to avoid falling. He claims that the intention to hang on to the root exists simultaneously with the action of grasping onto the root. Now, I actually think Craig is absolutely correct. However, I don't think it helps his case. It seems that Craig is not making an important distinction here. Firstly, one kind of intentional action is something to the effect of, I want to act to change something about the state of affairs. And another kind of intentional action is something to the effect of, I want to maintain the current state of affairs. Now, that second kind of action could be properly understood as having the action and the desire as being simultaneous. But it seems that the creation of the universe was the first kind of intentional action, which does require a temporal realm as it needs chronological priority. So you felt that his answer didn't solve the problem that you were asking, Justin. The same thing from Rob, who is in the Netherlands, I think. His email is entitled Kalam Strawmen, and you've got a number of objections to Craig's defence of the Kalam cosmological argument on the programme. But you also bring out a very similar thought to Justin Sheba on his answer on the intentionality and chronological priority and that kind of thing. You also were not happy with how he answered whether the universe beginning to exist is the same as other things that we know of that begin to exist. You say the universe beginning to exist is completely different from objects within the universe. Every beginning of an object that we know so far is the rearrangement of pre-existing material. There was no pre-existing material for the universe to be formed from. So since the manner in which objects begin to exist differs inherently from the way that the universe began to exist, there's no ground to consider the necessity of a cause equal. If you want to revisit some of the sort of, these are quite technical comebacks on Bill Craig's contribution last week, I do encourage you, if you didn't get it, to go and listen to the programme where we, as it were, take it from the start. That's available, of course, at the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Others who have emailed in, quite a few emails responding to this, Hung Wai Chi, who I asked a question on your behalf, Hung Wai Chi, and I'm sorry, your email seems to suggest that I didn't ask it quite in the way you wanted to, but you say in this email, you may think that Craig answered my question, and your question was essentially about whether the first premise of the Kalam argument, that everything begins to exist, has a cause, is true, kind of in the same way that we just heard from Rob. But he only answered the challenge of intentionality versus time. He avoided the issue of causation and time. I can understand you were limited by time due to the length of the programme, but neither of the questions really challenged Craig, whilst my question actually challenges the very first premise of the Kalam argument. Now, on another issue, which was an objection to the fine-tuning of the universe argument, you say, I noted Craig failed to address the teleological question adequately. The challenge put to him was not that a helium universe may require fine-tuning, but that fine-tuning argument could be applied to any type of universe. I'm rather disappointed you didn't pick him up on that, as you're normally very astute on these things. This was because there was an objection from one emailer, or a kind of question put, well, what about, you say our universe is fine-tuned to produce life, but wouldn't a universe full of helium also be fine-tuned to produce helium? Bill's answer, as I recall, was that, well, you simply don't have to have as fine-tuned a universe to produce helium. There can be quite a lot of variation in the initial constants of the universe for that type of a universe to exist, so it simply isn't fine-tuned in the way that we understand our universes. So I don't know. It depends what distinction you're trying to draw there. Get back to me, Hung Wai Chi, if I've misunderstood where you're coming from on that. Thanks to others who have been getting in touch over different things as well. Just want to get to a couple of these. Lots of new listeners who have been emailing in the last few weeks. Natalie says, writing to say how much I love the show, discovered it a couple of months ago, but have been downloading all the podcasts to catch up. I think I've listened to around 100 of them in 2 months. God, you must be sick of me by now, Natalie. You say you especially love the Gorilla Christian episodes. David Robertson is great. Natalie, you say, I'm not a Christian or an atheist, but I find myself defending Christianity more and more. I've only recently started taking an interest in the question this year after watching a Richard Dawkins argument and wondering what the arguments were for the other side. I think it's great that Dawkins and co. have opened up a conversation about God, and your radio show has continued these conversations. I wish more people my age were interested in discussing some some of the big questions. I still have lots of questions, but find myself more and more convinced that there is pretty sufficient evidence for the existence of God, even if I still have doubts over certain aspects of the Christian faith. Anyway, just wanted to let you know how great and important the show is for people like myself who are genuinely searching and open to the arguments of Christianity. Oh, and I also love the accent. Thank you very much, Natalie, who I think you're emailing from Australia, I think. So thanks, very encouraging email. Kyle Lawrence, I'm a new avid listener from Los Angeles, California. I read Daryl Bock's blog and he mentioned his appearance on your show. I've been downloading and listening like crazy ever since. One of my primary faith struggles throughout my life has been reconciling my doubts vis-a-vis the apparent extreme confidence of atheists. But hearing your shows and the well-reasoned responses by your guests has really helped to bolster my intellectual understanding of the validity of Christianity. You go on to suggest that you'd love to see Dr. Hugh Ross on the program. I agree. We had him sort of by phone at one time last year, but it'd be great to get him on again. And you also say, have you checked out something called the Jesus Christ Show over here in the States? It's a traditional call-in show, but the host answers questions as Jesus Christ. I know it sounds a bit odd at first, but he does a really terrific job of answering people's questions with very biblically sound responses. And I found his answers to some of the toughest questions people have to be very helpful. I don't know about that, Kyle. I like that idea, the Jesus Christ show and someone answering as though they were Jesus Christ. I mean, yeah, that's quite a mantle to be taking upon yourself. Certainly not one that I'd like to. But interested in your response. Have you listened to that show? If you're listening and you're in Kyle's area of the States, I wonder what your thoughts are on that approach to doing theology, apologetics and discussion. Thanks to all others who have been emailing me. Keep them coming in. And I look forward to reading out more in due course. Okay, that's all for today. Come back next time. We've got another interesting show for you, kind of in the Gorilla Christian format. Let me explain. You're unbelievable. Well, Peter S. Williams, who was with us today, returns to talk about his new book, Understanding Jesus, looking at Jesus from a historical, biblical, theological, and philosophical point of view. And he's going to be taking some questions from some skeptical listeners to the show. So they'll be coming on the line and asking those questions, a few of them during the show. So it should be a good time had by all at the same time next week. Hope you can join me for that here on Premier Christian Radio on Saturday at 2:30 p.m. or indeed online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until then, have a great week.